Affairs of March 15th, it's 8:07, call to order. Representative Peterson is here, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson. And I'll be chairing temporarily until Representative Lynn gets here. He said he'd be a bit late. So with that done, I think what we have today is HB 169 and HB 176. And I will not make a statement of intent. What we intend to do the bills, we'll save that for the chair. So Representative Gatto, if you'd come forward and introduce yourself for the record and tell us about HB 169.
And can I repeat my famous aid at the same time?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, it looks like I'm going to need 100% of the committee to get this thing out of here. So, like they said,
it'll be convincing.
It started out, we're in a member of Reg Review, and Terry Lauterbach was in there, and we were talking about when some things came before her, how come I was never notified? And she said, because it's the law. I'm not allowed to notify you. And I said, how do we get a law like that? And she said, you guys make the laws. I said, can we fix the law? She said, absolutely. So I asked her to write a new paper for me that showed us how we could fix it. And it centers around this. Who can be notified? Now, even though you were the one that asked for a review, you weren't on the list that could be notified when the review came back. And I said, well, let's fix this. So basically what HB 169 does, it adds some people that are entitled to receive notification ordinarily. And it adds the committee that requested the review, the prime sponsor, of all things, and the requester that the regulations meet statutory standards. There's a lot more I could say, but basically before that, it allowed certain people to receive the a legislative review of documents. So we have, that's it. I'll be happy to entertain questions. We got some real department experts behind me and next to me who be happy to answer questions. Then we'll give you some time.
Any questions from the committee? Well, there's
remember, you're my friend, Paul.
I guess I do. Generally, if we have something that has a list and it says they may consult, that the list is not exclusive, do we have a situation here where we have an exclusive list that says that only these people can be notified?
It's true, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, higher up in that statute, you have, I think, on your table the relevant statute. In sub B, sub 2, it says, propose the regulations requested in writing to be reviewed by a standing committee, administrative regulation review committee, or the legislative council. That's the list of people who can request.
Sarah.
Yes, sir.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, sure. My name is Sarah Munson. I'm staff to Representative Gatto. Okay. I apologize.
I'm sorry.
No, I totally forgot to do that. So when you are looking in our bill, in HB 169, where it says may consult, that's just in determining the review and actually reviewing the regulation. But notifying of the results of that review or requesting that review initially, that list is I think, a definitive list, not a may, not a includes, but can include others. I think it's just this definitive list in B sub 2. But I think that Lisa Kirsch from Legal Services can answer that more clearly if I didn't do that.
Follow up, Representative Seaton?
Follow up. Well, as I understood the procedures was that if there's newly enacted legislation or the regulations were reviewed by the Reg Review Committee to see if they're consistent with the statutes, and it didn't have to be requested by a member of the legislature for the Reg Review Committee to have that
review?
That analysis take place. So, am I misunderstanding the procedures?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't have that answer, but I think that Lisa Kirsch or Deborah Baer could answer that question for you. I know that the statute says that legal services in Legislative Affairs Agency is the one who conducts those reviews, but I don't know where the sharing of that comes in with the Regulation Review Committee. So I would have to ask them.
And at some point, I'd like that clarified.
What the procedure is. We'll let the legal services answer that question when they come forward. As I understand it, the there's different. You know, I mean, the difference probably is the sponsor versus who's on the reg review committee. You know, it expands it. But anyway, maybe I didn't understand it. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to you is. You know, not only I think all legislators, every legislator should be, because if we passed a bill, not only are you involved, but I am too. If I voted for that bill, and the regulations don't follow what we intended, I think we should be notified right away. I think that's important. So I don't think just one legislator just automatically send it to all of them, because that's important that our intentions are carried out. So I don't think just one legislator, because we've all voted on it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think almost everything we pass is somehow going to be subject to regulations, and you would find probably your email box would be pretty well loaded. These are the ones that were specifically requested as controversial or maybe not going to the bill. And it was a matter that Terry said, I'd love to, first of all, the chairman on Reg Review said, I'm allowed to send these out to anybody I want to once you give them to me. And she said, absolutely. And I said, well, wouldn't it be easier if he didn't have that responsibility? Can we send them out to the bill requester, to the sponsor, to the people that had an active interest in the bill, that they were a part of creating the bill? And that was Terry's suggestion, and I went off of Terry Lauterbach's suggestion of who else should be included. I didn't do the blanket thing. I didn't want to put it on her to make sure everybody was notified, but rather just the people that she thought were important. So that's where we stopped it.
Sarah, did you have something to add to that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's also another issue further in this statute. Sub G says, except as provided in this section, the Legislative Affairs Agency may not release any information regarding the review of a proposed regulation under this section. So there's a confidentiality issue at stake here. There's a, and I think that both of our experts can testify to this more expansively, but the problem is that when you are talking between a legislative branch and the executive branch, the state agency that is creating these regulations, you want to keep communication open. And if everybody has access to those regulations, there's a fear that the state agencies might stop being as transparent as they are right now if everyone sees their words, because there's a problem with things need to be run through the bureaucratic channels within state agencies. So when you talk to a staffer, they have to run it through the boss, has to run it through their boss. And often with regulation review, they just need to know, why did you do it this way? And that might not have to be run through the bosses, but if it's going to go to every single legislator, it's going to have to go through the bosses, and it's going to slow down the process. So, but I think that they can speak to that much more clearly than I can.
I'll wait until they come up and ask.
Great. Okay, thanks. Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if we've got a newly enacted legislation, and so we're assuming that sometimes Ledge Legal doesn't foresee some problems with the regulations that are going to have to be created if that legislation passes, or I'm trying to figure out what the need for this bill is.
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I'm not sure I fully understood your question, but newly enacted legislation often nets regulation, which requires some kind of review. And if that review turns up that doesn't meet statutory standards, This bill simply allows Ledge Legal to notify the prime sponsor of that legislation that the regulation that came out of their bill did not meet statutory standards. So it's not, I think they're already reviewing all of those regulations that come out of newly enacted legislation. It's just a matter of who gets notified at the end of that review.
Oh, all right. Okay, just for the record, Sarah, this is Sarah's first time that she's ever presented a bill. So she's nervous. She doesn't look like it. Very confident. Just a reminder that you're supposed to always remind us to state your name before you talk, because the recorder, and I had to learn, they had told me that 25 times, so don't feel bad. I also want to recognize that Representative Grunberg has joined us. Any other questions for the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, Corvato, if I could just make a statement that we often pass legislation that is in conflict with law. And it shows up clearly, and I think Representative Grunberg would see this. We've been on the same child protection bill for a month trying to write the bill, and it has grown from 20 to 28 pages. And somewhere in there, I bet there's a conflict with statute. And then it would go and it would be identified in reg review and come back, and what do you want to do about this? But should we send that out to the world or to the people who are involved in the legislation itself and say, well, here's what we wanted to say. And we have some issues like with sexting, where we just can't get the language down. We know what we want. We know everybody knows when they see it, but it's so hard writing the language. If we wrote the language, I bet it would come back to us as a violation of some law. So what Reg Review is doing essentially, and you were the chair of Reg Review, you know that that's what we're trying to make the statute match, or trying to make the new law match the existing statutes.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. I had a conversation with two members of the Supreme Court last week that surprised me a lot. When they came with the chief to address the legislature, they had a few people talked with them in the speaker's chambers afterwards. And I asked them if they were aware of the booklet that comes out by statute every year, where the reviser of statutes, Ms. Baer knows what I'm going to talk about here, the reviser of statutes does a report to the legislature on any newly enacted regulations or court cases that suggest legislative review. It's somewhat similar to what you're doing. And at least these two justices, there were three of them there, and I didn't ask the chief if he was aware of it. But the other two justices that were here had never heard of this booklet and certainly weren't aware of the statute. And I have a note today to call the folks over at Ledge Legal, as I promised I'd send each of them a copy of this book. And I'm going to put a note and say, you know, if you're interested, you should just ask Ledge Legal to make certain that all and I think it should be Supreme Court justices and Court of Appeals judges, too, and maybe Superior Court judges, get a copy of this so they can see that the legislature is interested and has to be interested if there are problems with what we've done. And that's kind of the same thing you're dealing with here with the regulations. Very similar policy. And I'm speaking now, Mr. Chair, to the chair of judiciary, and you're on judiciary too. It used to be, and I'd like to recommend it again since I'm digressing for a minute, that we devote part of a hearing to a little report from Ledge Legal where they go through the book and they say, well, you guys should take a look at this and not this. And that made a real difference in we passed some bills because it had come through that book. And I think that what we're doing here may very well, and I support your bill,
thank you,
may very well be result in some really good things coming from the legislature, and looking at the forest rather than the trees.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg is a great and helpful comments. Was there a question there for the sponsor?
Do you agree? No, there wasn't. It was kind of a soliloquy. It wasn't a Hamlet-like soliloquy, but exactly.
I confess that was rhetorical. Sincere, thank you for the comments. I mean, I appreciate it. Representative Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I understand we're focusing on the prime sponsor of legislation, which may be a dozen people that were prime sponsors on pre-filed bills or something. But it seems to me that, unless I'm missing it in here, we have committees of jurisdiction in the House that look, that have, their responsibility is to review and look at all of these areas of law. And when these regulations come out, part of the duty of the chairman that has jurisdiction over that topic is to see what regulations are being passed and whether they're consistent with the area of jurisdiction. And when I was vice chair of reg review, I sent a memo to all House majority members or members that were chairman of any committee and making sure that they were aware that their committee staff should be reviewing the regulations that are proposed by agencies to make sure that's consistent with the jurisdiction on which the committee has purview. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out whether we actually want to have the committee chairman that has jurisdiction over that issue covered in the regulation be notified more so than a prime sponsor of legislation that may have been 8 or 10 years ago. They may not even be, might be on finance committee instead of judiciary or resources or something. And it seems like it's the duty of the committee chair to be monitoring the regulations on those. And I'm asking whether that is something that ought to be added to this legislation.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think you make a good point. The prime sponsor, as long as we have enough notification going around, let me back up just a little bit. We almost shouldn't pass a bill without knowing what the regulations are. That's been the surprising thing that's happened to us over and over again, but we don't have that option. So we're going to have to see the regulations maybe a year later, maybe longer, see how they're affected in the bill, because regulations can change forever. And if the regulations go back to the prime sponsor, that's the person who has the most invested. The committee chair might only be here for the simplest reason of allowing the bill to be heard and really does not have a strong attachment to the subject of the bill like the prime sponsor would. So if I understand you correctly, you want the current committee chair or the committee chair at the time the bill was passed to also be on the notification list.
Mr. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we have policies here that we have chairman and that their responsibility to have purview over certain subject matter. And we have people that have, you know, I'm not even sure that this is somebody that was in the House when something went through. And, you know, they might have been the sponsor of the parallel legislation and the Senate version passed. And so they wouldn't get notification because it was somebody from the other side. So I guess what my concern is that where we're talking about a long duration, somebody was a prime sponsor of legislation, and this may be a number of years later that there's a regulation that is affecting that.
Right.
But it's somebody who just put in the parallel legislation, and that's the, and my thought is that the notification should be to the committee chair who has current actual jurisdiction over that and should be concerned not with that particular piece of legislation but should be with particularly subject. Concerned with that subject as assigned by the by either body.
Representative Gatto.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Seaton, I think you're absolutely right. They should be And, you know, as an example, my first year here in 2003, I was education chair. Well, today, Alan Dick is the education chair. We passed things in 2003 that been here the whole time, and they're not coming back to me. They should go to, and I think you're right, they should go to Alan, or Representative Dick, to take a look at it, because it might have been where we moved the learning opportunity grants into the student-based allocation formula, and then how was that taken care of, and are we doing new ones now? Well, that happened in 2003. He wasn't privy and never will be privy to it, but a regulation could come up on something along those lines. So I agree with you.
You may. This is not a question for the sponsors. It's a response to Representative Seaton. But in the existing law, the chair of the committee that has purview over a particular bill and that has the authority proposed to request a review. And I think the presumption is that that's part of the committee chair responsibilities to both get the review and then you're in the loop. In other words, the initiative in the law that was passed out there, 2420-105, Part B, reviews shall be conducted under A of this section in the following order of priority. And then number two, under that, proposed regulations requested in writing to be reviewed by a standing committee. The review has been reviewed and whatever. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chair, that to me that's a little different subject, that the standing committee has the authority to request a review of a regulation, but whether the committee and the committee chair's staff that is in charge of looking at that is going to be notified of the potential conflicts that are reviewed by the regulation reg review specialist, the attorney, if the committee chair that has jurisdiction over that didn't specifically take and make a request for a review of regulation, they don't get notification.
Thank you for the clarification. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've handed out a statute, AS 24.05.182. Do you have that there?
Yep.
You do. Okay. And this is a statute that, frankly, I wasn't aware of until the day before yesterday. And one of my tasks in my caucus is we're going through and we're looking at the uniform rules, and I'm supposed to instruct them on those. So that means I've got to learn these things myself. And yesterday dealt with a couple days ago dealt with this subject generally. This statute, first of all, there are three things. There's number one, the statute that you were talking about, Representative Seaton, or one of you was talking about, AS 2420.105, which deals with the legislative affairs agencies, Leg Legal, that they're supposed to look at this. Then there's the statutes that deal with the Administrative Regulation Review Committee. And then there are these other sets of statutes that deal with the duties of the standing committees. So it's divided into three things. And what we're talking about and what Representative Seaton's been talking about is the very last of those three. I haven't looked at the first dealing with Section 2420.105, which I'd have to look at. And it doesn't talk about the triggering mechanism. And that's what we're really talking about, is the triggering mechanism. And I want to use, if I may digress for a minute, Mr. Chair, Section 2405.182 dealing with the standing committees as sort of a paradigm. And I think we need, and maybe this bill's a good vehicle, to enact the triggering mechanism. And what this says in sub A, a standing committee of the legislature furnished notice of the proposed action under AS 4462-190, with which I am not familiar, and probably we need to look at that, shall review the regs. And I think that I would ask maybe either the committee or the sponsors of this legislation to look. We should be absolutely certain that each of the committee, the executive agencies, when it passes regulations, as well as notifying the sponsors in here, should notify Ledge Legal, Administrative Regulation Review, and the Standing Committee. So it's covered on three fronts, and there's really automatic notification. And that way, both our legal counsel and the committee, the Reg Review Committee, and the Standing Committee, whether it's Hess or Transportation, Judiciary, or State Affairs, and all the, half the committee chairs are sitting in this room at this time. Oh, sorry, resources. I guess we have Anchorage Caucus half of that, too. I'm the only non-chair here. The,
no, there's three of you.
anyway, so that you, ladies and gentlemen, get notified. But the triggering mechanism is the key thing. And that way we won't have a problem like with the justices on the Supreme Court where they say, we didn't know anything about this. That way you'll each absolutely get notification and the system will work better.
Do you have a response, Representative?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think you make good sense, and if that'll, and I think it would make the bill better. You're going to propose an amendment. I'm not going to object to it.
Mr. Chair, I'm not prepared to do it at this moment because I haven't read it, but if we could take another day or so, I'm happy to work. I seem to volunteer for something
well,
like this.
Well, through the chair again, Representative Grunberg, it's coming to judiciary, I believe. And if it does, that's our spot.
We can do it there.
It.
Fine.
And, I saw a question. I guess not. I would just add to that that as a past Reg Review chair, this is a very good bill. Probably the whole Reg Review system needs to be revamped so we pay more attention. I personally think that it would be harmful to your bill to make it a Reg Review reform bill. That's just the opinion of the chair if you didn't ask for it, but I think you have a really good bill. And I have a question, though. You have a notification and you've got the consulting in there, and the last on the page two, the down in 8, 9, and 10, right there toward the end of the language you added, if the reviewer, if a review is requested and the reviewer determines that there's no problem with the regulation, that's the end of it. You know, and I guess I would just like to put out there a question. It's not even necessarily for you, but Lisa's listening, and I'm hoping that she will respond. I'm wondering if we shouldn't put in some kind of accountability or protection for that attorney. Like maybe require two signatures or something, because it'd be easy, I would think, humanly speaking, to just say no problem, depending, you know, to ease. I mean, if the workload varies or if there happens to be some kind of a situation, just to protect us politically and realistically, some kind of protection for our attorney. If it has two signatures on there, that means two legal services attorneys have agreed there are no problem with the regulations. And personally, I have to admit that I have seen regulations that I didn't agree that they applied, you know, and it would just seem like an extra check and balance in there that might be helpful. And it's just a suggestion. I'd like to get your feedback on it, and hopefully legal services has some comments too.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I thought there was a conflict in the regulations versus the legislation, and legal services came back and said no problem, well, remember, I'm the one that asked the question that I had an issue, so can I get a second opinion? Is that essentially what you're saying?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the sponsor?
We're talking about
raise your hand. And
Sir?
This is Sarah, for the record, Sarah Munson. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to call your attention just very quickly. The statute as it stands now, illegal services can't notify you. If the regulation meets statutory standards, that really is where it ends. They don't notify. what our bill does actually allows them to, it says that they shall notify even if there is no problem. It doesn't say in writing, so they can just do a quick phone call, but I think that that is a little bit of an accountability. They need to call whoever requested and say, we did finish your review, and there is we find no problems, and that gives you an opportunity, I think, to discuss it with them. And I don't know about their accountability mechanisms within their own department, but I know that that in our bill will at least help with that, and also allow you to know that the review has been finished. Because I think sometimes it just, you request it, and then it, if you never hear, you just hope that the review was finished and it, there were no problems.
Okay, very good input. Representative Grunberg.
Representative Seaton pointed out that AS 24.20.105C requires that under AS 4462190A7, notice of proposed action along with a copy of the proposed regulation shall be furnished electronically by the state agency to the legislative affairs agency, the chairs of standing committees with jurisdiction over the subject matter of the proposed reg. Number three is administrative regulation review committee. Number four is legislative council. And I don't know if that's currently being done. I would hope either in this committee or in judiciary at the next hearing on this bill that we get a report on whether that's actually being implemented. That's number one. But number two, that's only for the during the period of public comment, which, and Ms. Baer can correct me if I'm wrong, is 60 or 90 days or something.
30.
It's only a 30-day window. And it's no time at all, particularly if it's during the session, and if we're out of session, people are fishing or being lawyers or whatever everybody else does.
Cabo.
Yeah. And so that's very little time, and I'd like to remind you folks of the bill we took up a few weeks ago in both committees dealing with the executive travel and attorney's fees. That was triggered when we got notified in a sort of a roundabout way of that particular subject matter, but we had to put a stop on the enactment of those regulations, and it wasn't really enough time to do the job. So really, and it was only proposed regulations, it wasn't after the regs were in place where we could see the final product. And I think what at least I'd like to see is that there be a real notification after the regs, because they've got to do the regs and to have enough time to do them, but we've got to be able to fit them into our own schedule. We're a part-time legislature, and maybe a mechanism that if they do notify and the committee chair has a concern, that there be some mechanism of putting a stay on that until we can really review, because 30 days is not, unless it's an emergency, enough time most of the time for the legislature to act and pass any legislation. We couldn't pass much legislation in a 30-day period, particularly it's less than that by the time we get notified and it comes through. So I think this is an opportunity, a train that we can really use to provide some reform here.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Gutenberg. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess, you know, maybe I have had an assumption that all legislators get the regulations that are being proposed by agencies, because I receive Fish and Game, I receive, I mean, always have.
That's right.
And actually, under the law, it says that they only have to notify the standing committees with jurisdiction over the subject. And so I would presume that, you know, we need to find out what the procedures are. If all legislators get the notice of all the proposed regulations, which I think is a procedure, but that's not what C says here. This says standing committee, the chairs of the standing committees.
That's a great question for Lisa when she comes up.
Right.
And I'm under the impression that we all get them, but maybe I presume something that I shouldn't have there. So we'll look forward to that.
Those are the ones you don't get.
Before we go further, I just want to point out Department of Law is online for questions. Deborah Barron, Steve Weaver, and I have made reference to the fact that Lisa is here. Okay. Okay. And
Deborah Mears.
Okay. She's here. Okay. I'm sorry, Deborah. And then I also wanted to say that Representative Lynn has been with us for about 20 minutes here at least, and the chair, and I'm holding off to give him the gavel when he says he gets it. So, just so you all know what's going on here.
Well, it gets complicated. I'll take it back.
So did you want to make a concluding remark, Representative Gatto, before we...
Mr. Chairman, just this. I get lots of email that says notice of proposed rulemaking. And if it's a subject that I'm not really involved with, we get so many of them. Now, are we saying that there are lots of notices of proposed rulemaking that I don't get? And by not getting them, I don't know that I'm not getting them. So perhaps Representative Seaton has a point. Electronically, things are pretty easy to do. And people that don't want to read things can just hit the delete button. But if they happen to want to read it, at least they did get notified, and they have no excuse after that.
Great. I have a question.
Oh, yeah, one more question. Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at right now at the Ledge Legal, the Legal Services memorandum. And in that, it says, I have deliberately not required this communication to be in writing so that a phone call could suffice. I would like to know what the intentions of the bill drafter are right here, because can they just leave a message? And sometimes the message phone doesn't get listened to for a long time. So do you want that telephone call to be in person? Or do you just, if you're not home, they can leave a message? You might be gone for a 3-week vacation or something. I mean, I would like to know what your intentions are here.
This is Sarah, for the record, again. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think that first of all, the no problems response not being in writing, that's only the no problems response. So that's not when there is a problem. That one has to be in writing. And I think that this is just because Ledge Legal does so many reviews that if they had to draft a memo for every single review that passed muster, I don't know that they would be doing anything other than writing memos saying that it passed muster. So, but I don't know if that phone call could be an answering machine, but I mean, as the law is written, I think it could be, because it just says shall notify.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Okay. Follow up.
And that's fine as long as it's no problem. I could accept that without any problem. And so if there is a problem, they have to do it in writing.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So at this point, I would like to apologize to Deborah. I looked at her and my feeble brain said Lisa, and so I went downhill from there. Deborah and Steve are here in the room from the Department of Law. Thank you. Lisa, if you would come up. Pardon?
They're both there.
Yeah. You know, Deborah and Steve, you signed up for questions, respond to questions only. So I was just thinking of hearing from our legal services. Yeah. Sorry for the confusion. It was all mine. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Not your turn, Bella. Do you want to get up here at the same time?
Might help.
Okay. I'll invite the Department of Law up also. But just for the record, so you understand, Lisa's the one that signed up to testify. Deborah is here for questions. I mean, they're all very gracious and putting up with my confusion. And great. So, Lisa, go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Lisa Kirsch. I am now a drafting attorney at Legislative Legal, but prior to that, I was one of the regs review attorneys, so I have some familiarity with the statute. I think maybe the best spot, unless people have questions directly for me, is just to give you an idea about the process. I think that might, you know, help clarify what exactly happens. Regs do go out to all legislators when they are proposed. The agencies are required to do that under the Administrative Procedure Act. Deborah probably can name the specific section, but it's in Title 44, sections or Chapter 66, probably around 190 or 180.
62.
Okay. So, anyway, the regs do go out when they're proposed. There generally is at least 30 days of notice before another step is taken. A lot of that will depend on what happens during the comment period. If there are regs that are more controversial, sometimes agency will give longer periods or they'll put them out to notice more than once. It just depends on the particular package. I receive all those notices, or I did when I was doing regs review along with all the legislators. So if anyone did have a problem with them at that point or wanted to request a member of a standing committee, wanted to request a review from the regs attorney, that could happen at that time. But generally what happens is they come in, the regs review attorney reviews them. If there are no problems, we do nothing. If we have questions for the agencies under this statute as it currently exists, we can communicate with the agencies. I can communicate with Deborah Bear or Steve Weaver at Department of Law. Oftentimes I will be referred to the Assistant Attorney General to help draft those regs or whatever. So I have a good working relationship with them and being able to communicate with them. And then if they lay my concerns to rest, I don't do, again, nothing happens. I just, you know, close the file and move on. If there are problems and legal issues, there are three things I'm looking for: just general legality and constitutionality, whether the agency has authority to adopt the regs, and then you know, finally, whether they're consistent with existing law. So that may be our own Alaska statutes, it may be federal law, but you know, that they fit within the scheme of everything else. So that's when I'll write a memo. My memo currently goes to the Regs Review Committee, to the Speaker, to the President. And under this change, we would also be able to give it to the prime sponsor if they're still in the legislature. It becomes kind of problematic if they're outside the legislature. And, you know, to someone who requested. That was the, you know, one change, because it had created this kind of odd situation where we had allowed the standing committees to request a review, but then later in the statute where it says, you know, it limits, it says we may not release any information, and then it limits the release of our review memo to a small group of people. That group did not include the person who had requested or the committee that had requested the review. So that was the one thing that this, you know, legislation was aimed to correct. So that's the general overview of what happens. The specific questions that I heard from Representative Wilson about sending it to everyone, typically memos that come out of legislative legal are confidential. There's a number of reasons for that, you know, in part because we're giving legal advice to a specific legislator. We have this kind of odd attorney-client relationship with many different people who are in the same body, but we just generally limit and direct our advice to one person and keep it confidential from another person, even if they ask the same question. So what we generally do is keep those memos confidential. I think that as Sarah Munson mentioned, there is some degree of openness that's possible because of that confidentiality. People are willing to talk to us and work with us because it's not something that's going to be widely distributed. I think there's also the issue, I think, that Representative Keller mentioned, that if it gets sent to everyone, it becomes kind of a glut of information because you're sending things to people who may not be directly concerned. And so it is kind of unnecessary and perhaps just creates more information out there than people are really interested in looking at. And I think maybe I'll just let you ask me any other questions that you may have at this point.
Any questions, Lisa? Representative Seed and then Representative Greenberg, did you?
I'm thinking.
Okay.
We were talking about the notification of regulations and that the statute that we're seeing before us only requires those regulations to go to LAA, the chairs of the standing committee, administrative review committee, and legislative council. That's on under 2420, 105, and C. And that's the notice of proposed action or proposed regulations. Now, is that actually being followed, or do the proposed regs actually go out to the public and to all legislators?
Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair, all of those things are happening simultaneously. I think Deborah probably can speak better to the groups that are covered under the APA, but this provision, as near as I can tell, is kind of belt and suspenders. It's actually, you know, going directly to those standing committees that have jurisdiction over the subject matter and making certain that those who are particularly interested will receive it. But agencies are required to send out to a broad range, and that includes members of the public who have asked to be on a list. Like if you're in an industry that's regulated by a certain agency, you can ask to be on a list that you will always receive the notice when the public notice goes out. It also gets published in newspapers and broadcast in other ways, depending on the nature of the regs. So, you know, those things are all happening. To the best of my knowledge, there are electronic lists of email addresses that are maintained that assure that happens.
Okay, and just to follow up, I guess I don't get two copies of regulations. I don't get one that goes to the public and then one that goes to legislators. So I presume those lists are, or as a standing committee chair, I don't get a separate two copies. So I'm getting one copy. I guess those are coordinated by the agency. So if you're already noticed as a member of the legislature or the public, you don't receive a second email as a member of the standing committee or as a chair of the standing committee. And so that's what I'm trying to find out.
I'm Deborah Baer, and I'm regulations attorney for the state of Alaska, and I'm employed by the Department of Law. And I assisted Senator Tyrio when he drafted this bill, so I can give you a little history about it. And one of the reasons why C is in there, Senator Tyrio was aware that under the Administrative Procedures Act, the public gets copies of regulations, legislators got them. The purpose of C, if you'll notice, it's kind of subtle. It says, along with a copy of the proposed regulation. Under the Administrative Procedures Act, not everybody gets copies. So that made sure that you didn't have to take the extra step to get a copy. The other thing, under the Administrative Procedures Act, it has legislative counsel. Legislative counsel did not get routine mailings under the Administrative Procedures Act. So it's kind of a blending of two things. But chairs of standing committees would get that under the Administrative Procedures Act. The advantage of this is you also get a copy of the regulations.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Seaton? Go ahead.
Yes. And I guess on the question that we're talking about of the memos coming out from Reg Review, now I can fully understand where agencies would not want to have memos coming out questioning the legality of their regulations and those going public so that people have a basis to sue over regulations. So is there anything in here that would make sure that those legal analyses of the regulations versus statutes will remain confidential to the prime sponsor as well as others, because it seems like we are now saying that legal review of the regulation, which might be questioned with the statute, would leave the confidentiality of the legislature. Am I correct or incorrect?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. I guess the way I look at the confidentiality provision is that it's a limitation on what I can do with the memos and who I can discuss the memos with. Once the memo goes out, it's in the hands of the holder of the confidentiality, basically the person who is listed in the statute, who has the ability to further distribute it if they choose to. But the limitation is on legislative legal. If you look in F of 2421.05, in G, I'm sorry, they may not release any information about their review, and that is on Legislative Affairs Agency, of which we are a part. So that's how the confidentiality provision controls. It works through the what we are able to release.
Does that answer your question, Representative Seaton?
It does. It's a little bit different than I had understood it, because I had understood that these legal memos analyzing that came to us when I was on reg review, that those were confidential memos that were not to be released to the public. But I'm...
That's correct. Yeah.
Yes.
That is how those...
Okay. So my question is, if we are now sending those notices and things to the prime sponsor of a bill who may be, you know, from things 10 years ago or not, is that same confidentiality of that legal memo maintained in this new rewrite of the bill, or does this say that those are now open for distribution?
They are, Representative Seaton, through the chair, they are under the changes in this statute, they are still confidential from my perspective when I am handing them out. I have a list of people that I can only give them to. One of the reasons we limited it to a sponsor who was still in the legislature was to maintain that same group of people that we have an attorney-client relationship with and have confidentiality between, you know, because it's within that same group. So if it is someone, like you were saying, that's been, you know, it's 10 years have passed since they were sponsored or something like that, and they're no longer in the body, then we would not send it to them under the changes here.
And one more follow-up, Mr.
One more follow-up.
And I guess the question was on, like, my understanding when I was on reg review, that those memos to us were confidential. We weren't to release them. You're telling me that my understanding at that time was incorrect, and that as the prime sponsor of past legislation, there would be no requirement that memo from Ledge Legal analyzing the state of Alaska's regulation and potential conflict with statute could be released to the public, and that there's no confidentiality standard on the past prime sponsor. I just want to make clear that that's what you're telling me.
When we give legal advice, it is, we may not release it further. It goes to the person who requested the legal advice, or in this case, the list of people who are in the statute who would get legal advice. If that person, as a holder of the confidentiality, wishes to waive the confidentiality and make that document public, they can do so. We have always encouraged the Regs Review Committee to not erode that confidentiality. But if they felt there was a need to do so, they can do that. There's nothing. There's no punishment associated with releasing that memo.
Clarification on that, maybe it'll clarify the whole issue. It will for me a little bit, but I don't think that notification is necessarily means that the confidentiality is waived in anything. A notification does not mean that the confidential memos are therefore released, neither does the consulting with the prime sponsor. So if I were to answer your question, and I'm not out there, you're the expert, I would say it doesn't change the confidentiality. It allows notification and consultation, which is not necessarily the same as releasing legal opinion. But maybe you could respond to that to check my meager knowledge.
I think what you're saying is basically true. The way we think of these things is, you know, they are confidential from our perspective. We do not further release, and so it's basically binding on legal services as to what they can further release. You know, it really is not something that is required by law to remain confidential. If they choose to release it, they can do so once the person has the memo.
Okay, thank you. We'll work on that. Representative Grunberg.
This is one of the more interesting and intricate bills I've seen in a long time. and it opens an absolute constitutionally crucial Pandora's box. And it really merits, and I see my friend the chair of the Judiciary Committee, it merits real look by this committee and by the Judiciary Committee. Because this is a place where the rules of confidentiality come up against the public's right to know. And that's really crucial. And what Ms. Kirsch is talking about is a very tiny aspect of whether the attorney can release this. And this statute sub G here makes it confidential. What we're talking about here, folks, under the Administrative Procedures Act, is not adjudicating, but rulemaking, government in the sunshine, and whether, in fact, the agency is overstepping its bounds. And I can think of few issues more important and more crucial than the public's right to know if that's an issue. We're talking here, and Representative Seaton has talked about, and this statute, 2420-105, deals with the proposed regulations. And we have a situation where it's a tiny time frame, people are not notified, and there's confidential issues. I can't think of a worse way of keeping things from the public than apparently is going on here. I am extremely concerned. When I walked in, I thought this was a nothing, no controversy bill, but I can see it is unlatching the door of something that's extremely important.
Yeah.
And the second aspect we have is the statute I've handed out, which is the examination of regs and opinions, 2420065. And that's the final product after the regs are in place that Ms. Kirsch and the people in LAA publish. And this is a book that the public should be extremely interested in. It goes to nobody. It doesn't go to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. It doesn't go to the governor. It doesn't go to the public. It really doesn't go to the legislators unless they request it. The Judiciary Committee for years has not been getting these. And I think we need to look at this stuff because it is absolutely crucial, and it's one of the key places in the public's right to know. And I'm very concerned. What I'm hearing is the bottom line is nobody knows what's going on. There's no real check on the regulation-making authority of the executive branch, and I think we should be vigilant to make certain that these are doing what we ought to do in the name of good public policy so the public knows what's going on here.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. I think probably what we'll do, and of course I'm going to submit to the wishes of the chair, is keep this bill over after everybody has their say, and then we can let the sponsor and Representative Grunberg, who has made numerous comments related to the bill, come to some kind of an understanding. I happen to really agree with the challenge, the points that you just brought up, that the reg review process needs to be reviewed and refreshed in our minds. I believe I'd like to ask Lisa.
May I inquire for just a second here?
Yeah. Representative Grunberg.
We've got a lot of people on both committees here, and the chair of the Judiciary, sponsor of the bill, has talked about doing this in Judiciary. My first question is, which committee wants to take jurisdiction over this bill to conduct this process, and then we can do it on whichever between the two committees wants to do it. I don't care who does it.
Okay. Well, Representative Grunberg, I don't think that's a decision I can make right now, and I think, like I say, I would prefer to have you talk to the sponsor, and we'll start, and then the sponsor, and you can talk to the chair of this committee, and we can move from there. Representative Wilson, you had a question?
Brief at ease.
I think this is for Lisa. when you were the reg attorney from Legislative Affairs when I was the chair last year of reg review, and I want to put on the record that you did a very good job. I really appreciate it. But it was an intimidating committee to be on, and it was because the scope of the responsibilities was much, much broader than I thought. And I went away after 2 years in that role thinking that probably at some point Legislative Affairs needs to expand our staff and capability in regulation review, which would go along with some of the comments that Representative Gruenberg has pointed out. But I guess my question for you is, when you get notified of regulations that are coming out from the various agencies, do you find the information that you were given sufficient, or do you end up having to do homework, rely on contacts and whatever to understand what's going on in those regulations?
Representative Keller, through the chair, I have always had very good help from the executive branch agencies that were adopting regs or proposing regs. I've often would communicate with them via email and get just what I needed. My experience was always very positive with them, and I was able to gather all the information I needed. You know, there were times that I disagreed with their interpretation of the law, or where I found problems that they hadn't noticed, and they thanked me for pointing things out that, you know, were unintended mistakes or just overlapping statutory and regulatory authority that they hadn't noticed. So it was always a very positive process, I felt, and that, you know, Terry and I were able to gather the information that we needed without a lot of difficulty.
And in response, that really wasn't my question. I also have found the agency to be very helpful. I was asking if the information you were initially given, maybe I should ask it this way, could it be improved on? And just to give you an understanding of what I wondered is if it shouldn't be in a format that was posted in a more friendly manner so that the citizens of Alaska could easily get the information that was driving any given regulation online. I mean, I know the agencies are moving that way. They're using, I think, rat files or whatever they call them to put them up so people, Dennis, for example, can have it so his computer can pull down anything that comes from the agency that has to do with dentistry, you know, and we're moving that direction. But I was really, what I was asking is, do you think that the agency, there are things we could do to get them to improve that process?
I don't know if that's really a question that I could answer. Perhaps Deborah would be better because she's, you know, in that branch of government.
Thank you, Deborah.
This is Deborah Barron. I'm regulations attorney for the state, and you've hit on an issue that is of extreme interest to the lieutenant governor. He's very interested in improving the electronic access to so that people can easily use our websites. And it's an issue that I will pass on to him and express your interest in.
Yeah, thank you. That may be an aside, and I apologize if it is, but I wanted that on the record partly to clarify the difference between that little piece of paper that we get with the stickies on it and what a review is from the our legal services on any given regulation. Go ahead, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to make a comment because it's very difficult when you get that white paper with the stickies on it. You break it open and it just says, well, we're going to review this and we're going to, and it just tells the statute and it doesn't tell us anything. And it's, you know, and so to sit down and try to figure out what's going on, you don't have a clue. And I think it should be very much, I mean, if they're going to change a statute or do a regulation or something, then they need to say right there what it is, because otherwise, you know, you're looking at this and it's all in Greek, really. I mean, it really is. And then we have to go and find the statute and try to figure out what's going on. And I think that it's ridiculous that they send it out in that format. It should be a format that we can understand exactly what's going to be done.
Deborah Baird, regulations attorney. Each agency handles that issue, and they're quite aware of it differently. Some of the agencies do what is called Dear Alaska explanatory letters that go on top of it, but I certainly will pass that. I train state agencies every year, and I do a statewide training class, and I certainly will emphasize that point when I do training.
Thank you, and I saw two questions down here. Representative Seaton and Representative Gruenberg, did you have no? Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and of course some of this comes from serving on Reg Review Committee in the past, but You know, we received the notifications that legislative legal had found discrepancies between the proposed regulation and statute, and this notification came to us, and then the agencies took that into consideration, modified the regulations, and went through. So I guess I'm a little bit trying to find out where this notice and provisions that we're going to the prime sponsor with, is that going to mean that notifications of proposed changes with the agencies are going to be noticed to everybody, even though we're working with the agencies and they may change the regulation based on the comment? Or at it's unclear to me what notification and information is going to be transmitted to past prime sponsors of legislation, and is whether that's going to be in the interim or whether that's a kind of a final report.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, when we receive public notices, depends on when the agency puts them out to notice. And then we do our review and try to finish it during the comment period so that that any memo that goes out that finds a problem with the regs will be received before the comment period is run so that something can be communicated back to the agency in a timely fashion. So that may happen during the interim. It just depends on when the regulations go out. They may go out in the spring, in the fall, in the summer. There's no way of knowing when regs will go out for notice. So the process would be prime sponsor of the underlying statute that led to the regs change. That person will get first the notice at the beginning of the comment period that goes out under the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, goes out to everyone. So they will receive that notice just as anyone else would. If they're on a standing committee or whatever, one of these listed groups, then they'll also get the electronic version of the regs changes as well. So they'll have that initial notice. Then under this change to the statute, the prime sponsor would receive any memo that finds problems. So if we review them, we find no problems, there's no memo, the prime sponsor won't receive anything. But if we do find a difficulty and some legal issue, then we will draft a memo and it will go to that prime sponsor, assuming they're still in the legislature.
Representative Seaton? And following up, I'm just trying to figure out, so this is in your correspondence with the agency before the agency may have revised their regulation. So this is, when I said interim, I didn't mean the interim between sessions. I meant the interval between the proposed regulation and the adoption of the regulation. Mm-hmm. So I'm unclear, and possibly in the next hearing we could come forward with something showing us a flowchart of when the regulation or when your communications are going to the agencies and what of those are now going to be going in at what time frame to the past prime sponsor of legislation that concerned. I mean, I presume that this means that if anything is a child, anything to do with child in need of aid, that Representative Coghill, as the prime sponsor of legislation 4 years ago, revamping the statutes, is going to get all of those communications on the Senate side because it involved those statutes, not a particular portion. But if child in need of aid statutes, if there are new regulations, then all that in that communication between you and the writ and the agency will go to him because he was a prime sponsor. There may have been four prime. I mean, I think Representative Keller may have been a prime sponsor of other legislation that has also dealt with child in need of aid. So I guess I'm trying to figure out where this octopus of internal or final regulation communication goes in, and I understand it's broader here, and I'd be happy to hear it the next one if unless you're.
And at least it's up to you. If you want to give a quick answer or if you'd like to think about that, go ahead and give your call.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I can give you one brief answer. I don't think we're contemplating sending every communication between the regs review attorney and the agencies. The regs review attorney would have the ability to consult with the prime sponsor, you know, if they had a question about legislative intent or, you know, exactly what the underlying legislation was intended to do, that might be a possibility for consulting with them. I suppose if the prime sponsor requested, you know, more information, that you could consult with them under the change to the statute. But I think the document we're talking about is the final memo that contains the regs attorney's review of the legality and constitutionality and the authority that the agency has. That memo would be the document that would go to the prime sponsor.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell me what do you do to learn what the legislative intent was? I mean, do you go back to and listen to committee meetings, or how do you figure that part of it out?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I have done that. I can go on to basis like anyone else, you know, and pull up minutes from committee meetings. I've done that. It just depends on the particular regs review package and the number of regs projects I have at one given time. I would often go in and look at minutes if I had a question about that.
Okay. I'm just wondering.
Thank you. Seeing no more questions, is there anybody online or in the room that would like to put their comments on the record in testimony for HB 169? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony, and we'll set this bill aside. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I just wanted to get a clarification on page 2, line 3, that implement newly enacted legislation. And I'm trying to figure out what our definition of newly enacted legislation is. And I just want to put it on the table so that the next time we're talking about this, at least we'll figure out, because we're talking about past prime sponsors, if they're still in the legislature in one portion, and it seems that this is talking about only a very small subset of that, which is newly enacted, and I don't know the parameters of newly enacted.
Okay. Lisa, have you noted that question? You don't have to respond now again, but if you like, go ahead.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we do review all regs that we have time to review. It's it's one of those things that's done within available resources. But you know, generally, what we're reviewing here is any proposed regulation that comes through. The provisions as to newly enacted legislation goes back to B1 and the nature of the review. So that is the provision that talks about the priority of the regulations and whether you do a review. If you do have too many regs to review within a chunk of time, we'll look at the newly enacted ones first. So that's already an existing law, the priority list of what order we'll review them in, if we have, you know, more than we can review at one time. And so this provision addresses the prime sponsor in connection with, you know, those that are newly enacted. Generally, what I looked at as newly enacted would be within the past 5 years or so. If it's been enacted some length of time ago and you have regs already in place and this is just an amendment of regs, I wouldn't ordinarily consider that newly enacted. But that's something that is an existing law, and this provision for who gets notified, and including the prime sponsor, is linked to that.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay, well, like I say, we're going to put this bill aside now. I'm going to take it easier a little bit and pass the gavel back to the chair. I want to comment that his mother's gavel is a very good gavel, good balance.
It works well. Good balance.
and last comment is, you may never trust me again. This bill, I thought, was going to take a half hour. It's been an hour and a half. So, did you, for the record, Rob? For the record, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to thank all the people who came. I'm going to say all the lawyers because you're all lawyers. And the staff. And Representative Gatto, you people, the lawyers, Ms. Baer, who's a commissioner on uniform state law, commissioner on uniform state laws, and Mr. Weaver and Ms. Kirsch, do an unsung job around here. It's kind of thankless. It's nitpicking. I love it, but I think most people's eyes glaze over. And I just wanted, it's not very often we have you folks in the same room. I can't think of ever before. And I just wanted to thank you on behalf of all of us.
That begs one last comment. Again, I apologize, Deborah. I know Deborah, you know, and behind her directly is Lisa, so I couldn't see Lisa. And then my, the other Lisa I know is blonde, this gorgeous blonde, and I just got it all mixed up there. So apologize. I know I'll never forget your name again, I bet. With that, I'm going to call Matt Ease, and we'll go back to Representative Lynn.
Chair's committee, would please come back to order. I'd like to.
No sponsor.
Yeah. The sponsor just left here.
Who's the sponsor?
Yes, the House State Affairs Committee, please come back to order. I'd like to thank you, Representative McKellar, for his able service during the last bill. I think that all turned out to be a little more complicated than we expected. I think there's some key issues raised in that, particularly the, as Representative Grunberg was stating. So much is not transparent, and I think it should be. So I think it was a wise decision to hold this over. We'll look at it more carefully at the next thing. I don't want to hold it up. With that, we're going to be hearing House Bill 176. We may or may not move the bill, but I'd like to hear your statement, sir, and we'll proceed. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, committee members, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Bob Miller from District 7, and also with me at the table is Troy Buffard, works in my office. And we are hopeful that what we're going to introduce to you today will be a trifle simpler than what you just dealt with.
Every bill is controversial to somebody.
I am certainly sure that is the case, sir. But perhaps we can at least state our intention clearly.
And before you go any further, I apologize. Would you, we have a CS here, I hear a motion to get.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move version LS0224 Bravo of House Bill 176. It's a blank CS for the working document.
Okay, I hear objection for discussion.
Mm-hmm. I'll object for discussion of the change.
Right. Thank you very much. Please, please continue.
All right. Essentially, there are any number of regulations and rules governing who is entitled to receive a permanent fund dividend each year. There are lists of folks and certain conditions that list out exemptions. The purpose of the bill that I have sponsored here is to try and fill one small hole. It came to my attention back around November that there is a small contingent of people who live in Alaska, and that's crucial. These are people who live here, residents, who have now taken jobs working with the Department of Defense. They are civilians. They are attached, however, to military brigades, in some instances as vital pieces of the safety contingency, and they are deployed. They are ordered by the DOD to travel to, in this particular instance, war zones. They are going with the brigades to Iraq and to Afghanistan, and they can be deployed to other locations. due to the length of their absence from the state right this minute, many of them are not eligible for the permanent fund dividend during that particular deployment. One fellow that we've spoken with has been deployed a few times. Some years he is eligible because he's not gone too long. Other years he's gone too long, he's not eligible. So the intention is to plug up this hole. I figure that people that are still working with our military and serving overseas and being shot at by live ammunition certainly still deserve a permanent fund dividend check if they still live here and intend to live here and continue to live here in the state of Alaska. I'll be quiet now and take any questions.
One question. Civilian expeditionary workforce, would you define that that term?
I will let Troy handle that one.
Okay.
Sir, for the record, Troy Buffard, legislative aide to Representative Miller. Sir, the civilian expeditionary workforce, those members that work for Department of Defense, is somewhat of a new term based on directive, DOD directive 1404.10. Over the years, as civilians deployed in support of the military, since the ground war started over in Iraq, there's been kind of a lot of confusion on what roles these civilians fill. And there was such a gap because there's so many new positions and so many new civilians going over and supporting that. It was just way too much confusion. So this directive really cleaned up that language, and it's quite a thick directive. But it took out all the confusion on who these civilians are, and in essence, in so many words, it clearly defines that these civilians are holding positions that are deployable. It clearly separates them from any other of the civilian workforce.
Do we have a guesstimate of how many of these people we have who are deployed? Now, this is only for a combat zone, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you have any idea how many people we might be talking about here?
In Alaska, sir, there's
yes, that this bill would address.
There's about, within the entire Alaska Command, there are about 53 civilians that are identified as members of the Department of Defense Civilian Expeditionary Workforce. And that's amongst the 7,000 civilians that work in Alaska for DOD.
Okay. We're getting a little tally sheet here, so I'll keep track of it. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've got three different areas here, and I'm not a military person, so I don't know the differences. So you've got combat zone, qualified hazardous duty area, and a danger pay post. Now, can you tell me what the definition of each of those are?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Troy Buffard. That definition is consistent with what the military uses, identified by U.S. tax code for tax exemption purposes and hazardous pay purposes. It's the same exact definition that the military uses.
Follow up. That doesn't tell me anything. I want to know, what is a combat zone, what is a qualified hazardous duty area, and what is a danger pay post?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, those are areas identified and as stated as much by various agencies like the Secretary of Defense, I can't name all of them, but those are designated areas that's how everyone in the Department of Defense is categorized when they, for pay purposes, for many, many other purposes.
Yeah. No.
But so I'm going to break. I know what she's saying because, you know, a combat zone. I was in Vietnam, as you were too. Thank you for your service. That was definitely a combat zone.
Absolutely.
But then we all knew what that was, right? That's where they're shooting. But what are the other two areas? And I'm not familiar with these other two areas myself.
Okay, I can try to clarify as much as possible, Mr. Chairman. The other areas that might be considered, because there's so much conflict on what and what is not considered a war zone, who declares war. There's other areas that are contingency areas, like recently in the Balkans
Well, what about, we have this horrible thing going on in Japan. We have warships stationed off there doing their best to assist possible radiation, etc. That's probably hazardous duty, I would think.
Through the sheriff?
Would that fall into this?
Could be. If that's what the area is identified as possibly, that might be also considered a hardship tour area. There's lots of categories of areas as far as where service members can serve. But the clear areas where there's combat being conducted, that's what these areas are.
That's the easy one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Follow up.
Yes, I broke in on you, but for my own, could you get us an actual DOD or whoever it is definition of these three? Was it three different categories? I beg your pardon, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, I would like to know exactly, because I have a person that is complaining about this, and they're stationed in Hawaii right now, and I don't know what that's talked about. I don't know if that's a qualified hazardous duty area. I don't know if it's a danger pay post. I want to know the definition in plain language so I understand what that area is, because that might include some areas that I might not want to have this zeroed in on. I'm not saying I wouldn't or not, but I just kind of want to know so I know what I'm dealing with here.
As a matter of fact, since you've asked the question, I'm sort of pondering what the DOD and the IRS definitions of those are as well. So we will get those clarified for you.
Thank you.
Very good. Any more, Representative?
That's it.
Who is next? Representative Seaton, and then Representative Keller.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on Representative Wilson's question, it's not only what's the definition, but what are those areas? In other words, is a danger pay post anywhere in the Philippines, because there is on some island a terrorist thing, so that's considered a danger pay post, or is it all of Indonesia or South Korea? So if those are stations, then we're talking different things. We just need to know. Thank you,
right,
Mr. Chairman.
Understand. And we'll get that for you as soon as we can.
Representative Keller.
My question is similar. It's not along the same lines. If when you look at the in Section 2 there, where it defines what the civilian expeditionary workforce is, it ties it to the Department of Defense directive, just at, like we were just talking about the definitions there reference the U.S. Code. But the definition can change. So what we do, if we just simply reference a Department of Defense directive, that we make the permanent fund available in at the whim, or I don't want to say whim, but it's, I know there's more to it than that. It's carefully thought out, but it's by somebody else is making the decision, not us.
And the federal government, in other words.
The federal government can change that. They could change their whole military to include not that's ridiculous, but I mean they could expand the civilian expeditionary workforce in years to come, and then we'd have a legal problem. So my question is, are you against putting the definition exactly what it is in our statute without reference to tying ourselves to those definitions?
I would have to say at this moment I have no objection to that language being inserted. Of course, what I might think would work, and of course this would be working through the process with this committee, would maybe to put it in plainer language rather than just simply quoting and lifting statute or regulation from the DOD, would be to put it into standard language of what our intention is.
Yes, I would like to see a direct definition. Was there three different things? A plain language definition of each of these three. I doubt that those are anywhere in statute.
I would probably tend to agree. They take a little bit of digging.
So do we know what it is we're actually considering here? Representative Wilson.
Okay, the military person that has contacted me has been out of the state for 10 years, and every year this person has qualified for a PFD until this year, this past year, and because they've been here 10 years, they didn't get one this year. Now, I don't know what slot they're in, whether they would be included in this or not. But they did not qualify this year. And so would they have to come back and get a residency for a year in order to qualify again?
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, that person is not deployed. Being assigned and being deployed are completely different things. Deployed personnel in support of any of these areas that you like definitions is totally different than being assigned. Orders are given to personnel that go and deploy, either TDY orders or TCS orders. I think you have an example
you,
there.
You may need to define those.
You're talking
temporary duty and permanent change of
station. Talking to a person that doesn't know anything about the military.
But those that example, and I'm familiar with that example that you mentioned, Representative Wilson, that is a completely separate issue that has nothing to do with this bill. That person is assigned as part of their duties somewhere else in the world. This bill covers only personnel deployed, and it's not even a military person at that. It's just completely beyond the realm of this bill, ma'am.
Okay, gotcha.
Like a PCS, permanent change of station, transferred to another state, this wouldn't cover that. TDY, you could be stationed here, then on temporary duty, wherever the TDY assigns you to go.
Okay. TDY.
What we are hoping is that we have clear language in here that indicates that the folks that we're trying to identify are current residents of Alaska. They intend to remain residents of Alaska, and they have proven over some course of time that even when they have been deployed, they return to Alaska. I don't know if we've got the language in here that will absolutely satisfy, but that's our intention. So we're looking for suggestions as well.
I think, through the chair, also the House Bill 190 that is going to come up is going to clearly address that issue also.
Yeah, please identify yourself. Help our folks over here.
That's Troy Buffard, aide to Representative Miller. In the case of, I can't remember that individual, I think it was Mr. Crowfoot. House Bill 190, I believe, was introduced last week. That's going to very much address that issue. And this one has absolutely nothing to do with it.
What is that bill? You said HB 1?
HB 190, Mr. Chairman.
And that is?
I couldn't quote it, but it's I believe the intent of it, Mr. Chairman, Troy Buffard. The intent is that a resident, which that still has to be defined, who signs up to serve in the military will be a brand new status. They won't have to worry about, no matter where they're assigned, they won't have to worry about qualifying for the PFD.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg, and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that here on page 2, page 3, that all of these terms are defined but by reference to federal law. I would suggest before you come back before the committee, you at least supply us copies of those federal laws. Otherwise, this doesn't mean anything to any of us.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one, just a suggestion. Number two, on the retroactivity provision, section 4, why did you make it retroactive 2 years rather than 1 year? Because if you're saying that if it passed instantly, you could put in your application this year, it would only be for last year. Why go back 2 years?
That is a good question.
Well, you think about it when you come back.
Yeah.
Flag it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a bill last year, I believe, on teachers that teach military in military kids in these areas that are were, I think they were danger pay posts or whatever those things were. They were in Indonesia, and they were in the Philippines, and to extend this permafund dividend status to them as well. And the question is, I guess you've already said these are civilians that sign up for a job with DO,
with Department of Defense, so correct, they're taking a job. And the question was that they, does this apply to those, will this apply to those teachers that get assigned to a post in the, in one of these areas where they are teaching students of, or teaching kids of U.S. military on base, and they're assigned the position where they are to go to, and is that deployed, or is this, does this exclude those people that are, have been civilians and signed up?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this bill does not attempt to identify and deal with other definitions of persons other than this civilian expeditionary workforce. So the teachers may or may not qualify under some other statute or some other rule or the list of exemptions under the PFD. They do have a list of who's allowed. This bill does not attempt to identify that group, only the civilian expeditionary workforce. As I understand it, the clearest example I have is a fellow in Fairbanks who is assigned to the Stryker Brigade. He's a civilian, but his job is essential to the safety of many aspects of what the Stryker Brigade does. When the Stryker Brigade is deployed, his orders are to follow the Stryker Brigade. They may go to a non-hazardous area. They may go to a war zone. They may stay right here in the state of Alaska. But his orders are to follow that group. He's assigned to them.
Representative Seaton.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to figure out, we're talking about civilians, so I guess the other word for this is contractors. So is this a case where we might have a contract with Blackwater, or it used to be Blackwater, to provide security, civilian security, and then they get deployed in the same aspect to for security of the Stryker Brigade or something like that, providing civilian security?
Through the chair, Troy Buford, Representative Seaton, this bill specifically excludes them and most contractors in this case. To meet the qualifications of this, this is a very narrow group of personnel, class of people. The contracting civilian issue was one of those sticking points with this, and the way we worked around that is contractors have the ability to negotiate their salary, and they're paid by groups like Raytheon and KBR and so on and so forth. That's the part of the economic decision as far as contractors are concerned. The group of people we're addressing here don't have that option. They don't negotiate their contract. They serve with the DOD. They're paid by the DOD, unlike any other civilian contractor, and they have no negotiation power.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
I think maybe we need also then a layman's definition of civilian expeditionary workforce. So that would help us to kind of understand who is in it and who isn't.
Ma'am, through the chair, Troy Buford, that layman's term is literally a civilian that works for the Defense Department that is deployable. That is exactly what this very large directive says.
Okay.
Follow up.
Also, and I am very sorry, but I just don't know military terms at all, and I don't know the difference between deployable and assignable, whatever. And so if you could have that available next time so that I really, really have an idea in my mind exactly who we're talking about, because I don't know the difference there. Sorry.
Be happy to try and clarify that.
I think deployed, like you stationed Elmendorf Air Force Base, and you were deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, and then you come back, but your PCS station permit is Elmendorf. assigned, you could be anywhere in the world. You're not necessarily coming back. And by the way, for anybody on the committee, I do have in my military status the ability to actually serve people into the military. So if anybody interested in that, I'd be happy to perform the ceremony.
I thought the people that were at Elmendorf base came and went.
They do.
Okay, so they're not going to be here permanent. So that.
Well, but while they're assigned, it's like being assigned. But it's like here, we all live in our home district, kind of assigned a home district, but we are deployed to Juneau during the session. But we still are assigned to our home districts. That's a bad comparison, but we're all deployed down here. Without combat pay, by the way, and perhaps we could use some combat pay sometimes.
Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess what I need to do is see the occupations these 53 civilians are currently occupied in. I mean, the one statement we have here is that somebody retired from the military, and it looks like so he can receive his military retirement pay, he took a position with the Stryker Brigade as a safety officer. So he gets paid as a safety officer, he gets his retirement pay, and then he's deployable. And I'm trying to figure out what this category of people and is, what jobs they occupy, and if this is the category also about, are these almost all retired military that are, instead of reengaging in the military, are getting their retirement pay and then taking this contract? Civilian Expeditionary Force just goes over my head as far as understanding what this is, who these people are, and why they are in this special category. And are not, if they're deployable, and why they're not part of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they are, like this person, it sounds like, is making an economic decision that they can continue to receive their military pay while retirement, as well as being hired here, then that seems to be an economic choice as well. So it sounds like the person could extend their military career as a safety officer, and then they would be eligible for their PFD. And I don't know if that's the circumstance. I'm just reading off the sponsor statement, that person's statement, and trying to make assumptions. So maybe if we could find out a little more on what the...
And if I may, at this point, because we're getting close to the end of the hearing, we do have Debbie Bitney online. She's with the PFD.
She's sitting behind her.
Only, and there you are. Welcome. Do you have any comments you'd like to make? At this point, I beg your pardon?
I'm just available for questions.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Bitney? Okay. Thank you very much. Any, obviously, we're going to have to hold this bill because there's a lot of unanswered questions here before we take any action or inaction one way or the other. So, any final comments you'd like to make?
Only one. As I understand it, in any given year, typically this would only cover about six people, so we're looking for a small group of people that we tend to believe are still very much entitled to receiving their PFD as they serve, even though they are not necessarily military. Some of these folks, I understand, have not ever been military. Some are former and retired military, but it's a mixed bag. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to hold this bill over, and we'll reschedule it at an appropriate time. And one comment here. Our State Affairs Committee has a jurisdiction over the Department of, the Homeland Security thing. I just want to put it on public record that I have, in fact, been in communication with the Homeland people about this horrible situation going on in Japan. I asked the information to come back. It looks like we're in pretty good shape as of this moment. Of course, it changes by the hour. I just want to put on the record that we are exercising our oversight what they're doing to protect Alaskans. And at this moment, it looks like everything is okay. But it changes. So that's on the record, and we'll be keeping the committee up to date on that. Our next committee hearing is on Tuesday. It's for Thursday. We'll be hearing Representative Gatto's bill, HB 88, and that's use of foreign law in American courts. And that's an interesting topic to me. Any other business to come before the committee? And I'd like to thank Representative Keller for filling in for me while I was adjusting my alarm clock. So it was set for p.m. Rather than a.m., and I figured the committee is not meeting tonight, I hope. So,
do we get to rate him?
We are adjourned.